Welcome to the Tour Life Podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a certified addictions worker who has been involved in the music industry since 1996. He knows the ins and outs of the road and its associated pressures and struggles. He's been there as a musician, tour manager, stage manager, sound engineer, production manager, and addictions recovery coach, and is the founding partner of Over the Bridge, which helps industry members who are at their most vulnerable cultivate and achieve long-term mental health and addiction recovery goals. In this episode, we discuss recreating Pantera home videos, providing recovery services on tour, helping a loved one through mental illness, post-tour depression, and much more. You can find him on Instagram at Ace Piva and at OTB Nonprofit. Here is my conversation with the truly hilarious and super insightful Ace Piva. Ace, it's so nice to have you on the show. I'm so excited to chat and hear your story. So could you start by telling us what you've been up to and how you even got started in the music industry?
Yeah, so my name is Ace Piva. Currently, I am a tour manager, sound tech, and addictions recovery coach for artists. I started off, grew up in Hamilton, Ontario as a musician, got my first drum kit when I was nine. My neighbor was a singer of a cheesy 80s rock band, brought me to a band practice where they played Radar Love, and I knew from that moment that this is where I was going to be. As I got older, I joined a whole bunch of bands and then became eventually like the mom or dad of every band. I was a year or two older than my bandmates. So I was like the first guy with his license on the car. And so I bought a minivan so I could truck all everyone's gear around. And so when, you know, our bands were like, okay, it's time for us to start playing shows. Well, now we have to learn how to book them. So, you know, we taped our demo with the old cassette player in the middle of the room where you hit play and record at the same time.
That's how the Rolling Stones used to do it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you just dub them off of each other. And I had misspelt bios and all that other stuff. And I looked in the back of the local magazine where it gave me a list of all the clubs. And I didn't know what kind of clubs they were, but I went to them all and I just handed off these little press kits. And in eventual, you know, they'd be like, hey, did you know this was a country bar? I'm like, didn't. I just seen the name on the back of this magazine and here I am. They're like, yeah, it's not the place for you. Right. so most of my bands were alternative or metal or.
Like throwing spaghetti at the wall, like seeing what sticks.
Yeah. I didn't know where to start. No one was, I asked people, are like, I don't know, just do it. So that's what I did. So once we started conquering the local scene a little bit, it was time for us to spread out. We did across Canada. So I did the exact same thing. The internet really wasn't a thing. Email was just kind of getting going. A lot of people didn't have it. A few people did. So it was a lot of calls and, you know, mailing out press kits and all this stuff. So there is a Canadian magazine called Exclaim, which is like a cross-country music, sort of like NME. Kind of, right?
But
this one you can get free everywhere and you wouldn't have to buy. It's just free on the corners and, you know, or in clubs or whatever. So I would look at the tour, like, in, and of course there's all these tour ads, you know, for these small bands, and they'd be like, you know, oh, they're playing Hamilton. I'm like, well, they're playing at the same club I played at, but they're also doing it all across Canada. So I'd pick out all the bands that were playing my local clubs, and then I would just look at their advertisement and see where they're playing across Canada, and then I would call 411, you know, just call them up and say, hey, do you have the phone number for this place? Because I didn't have a phone book for Winnipeg or Saskatchewan or Edmonton. So I, you know, just racking up all these charges. My parents are getting pissed off at me because I'm phone bills coming in, and you know, the cost of calling long distance wasn't as good as it, you know, the prices weren't as friendly as they are now.
The good old days. You know, that actually, that magazine, it reminds me of Backstage, because Backstage is now an app, but okay, it used to be just a magazine, and that's where they posted like acting gigs and stuff and like voiceover stuff.
Yeah.
So that sounds really cool.
Yeah. So and that's how I just kind of found the venues that we were playing, you know, and then they would say, well, who do you want to play with? I'm like, tell me your five top local bands. And MySpace was just kind of getting going. So for those who had a recording, you know, I'd go on there and I'd look them up on MySpace, or the promoter would give me a bunch of random numbers, and I'd track people down. And like, I'm tracking down either 17, 18, 19 year old kids. So I'm like talking to random like mom and dads. And so hi, is John from this band there? Yeah, he's, out at band practice right now. It's like, okay, I'll call back later. And just track these people.
Oh,
down.
That's the best.
And then eventually in my later 20s, I'm 41 now. Everyone, it was just time for everyone to get a job. Everyone wanted to, start their families and their careers. And I can't blame them for that. But I wasn't quite ready to become an adult yet. But because I had already done all that stuff, learned how to book a tour and all the van rentals went on my credit card, and you know, my bands did stupid shit. You know, my band was I don't think it was a typical band, but some might, you know, like that we watched the Pantera home videos and we copied them. You know, we got kicked out of hotel rooms, we flipped tables, we took one van back with over $3,500 worth of damages, just because like guys are drunk and kicking it in a parking lot while you're hanging out with a bunch of other 19, 20 year old kids drunk in a parking lot in the middle of nowhere. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, it's so like Animal Farm.
Yeah, it really was. Like we just kind of like took those Pantera home videos and we know we had our own couple videos, and we just messed things up. We're sleeping on in parking lots, people's front lawns. We did learn that if you slept near water, it's a little bit more refreshing when you wake up.
Oh, because you get that breeze off the water.
So I was sleeping on top of the van. If it was raining, I was sleeping under it because we didn't have room. We didn't have money for hotels or anything like that. And if we couldn't find a place to crash, well, we were sleeping in the van. Yeah. So once all that party was going, and the guys, you know, it's like, oh, we can't be living our life like this or else we're going to die. I found an ad in the back of a local magazine, the same one that I used to get like the local clubs out of it. And it had, it was like, this little ad's like, hey, you want to be a tour manager? Call this number. I'm like, oh, this looks sketchy. Let's give it a call. You know,
it's like a human trafficking phone number. No.
Yeah. Like I didn't know what to expect. Right. And I had this management name on it. I'm like, yeah, I think I've heard of them. And so I called them up, and it turned out this management group had two offices, one here and one in London, UK. And at the time they were managing the Spice Girls as their four piece and the Pixies. Right. So I was like, okay. But their Canadian office did a band called Lowest of the Low, who's fairly big up in this area, and a couple like up and coming local acts, right? So I was like, okay, these guys are somewhat legit. So it was a 10-week course, and I ended up at the top of my class, and I was the only person with like touring experience that had gone through this thing, right? So everyone's like, well, you know, how about this? I'm like, nope, that's not going to work. This is what happens when you do this. You know, you're going to be eating shit for a day if you do that. Right? So once I was done the class, they put me out on tour as my first TM gig with an artist from the UK, and we flew down to South by Southwest, and we did the Viper Room in LA, and then we did a show at a place called the Living Room in New York, And then we did, it was like a press sort of thing. At the time, the artist had like a song on a World Cup commercial and a few other things, right? And I was told ahead of time that this artist had a coke problem. So it was sort of like, just keep my eye out on it, right? So I was like, all right, you know, first TM job. I wasn't a recovery coach back then, or anything like that. So we were in LA and we're playing the Viper Room. And we're playing with other bands that it was like the band that we were playing with, it was like the side project of a major band, right? So it was like, okay, all the guys from that band's here. It's pretty cool. But everyone's known for their cocaine use. All right. So it's like, okay, well, I know I need to keep an eye on my singer tonight. At one point he approached me. He goes, well, you know, this is my tour, right? I'm like, yeah, it's your tour. He's like, give me the float. Give me the tour float. And I'm just like, I can't do that. Like it's for the tour. And plus I seen you get like $700 out of the ATM the other day and you're not walking around with a guitar or like a Nintendo or anything. So like, I don't know where that money's gone and I'm not about to give you the money that we have. Right. And, so he threw a bit of a fit. He called his manager. He's like, I'm going to call my manager. I'm like, okay. And so the manager calls me and he was in England. And so it was like 6 o'clock in the morning over there. And he's like, hey, did you give him the money? I'm like, nope. He's like, okay, good night.
And and he had warned you about that, right?
Yeah.
So he was just making sure you did your job, which was to not enable it.
Yeah. I'm like, nope. And, but I did give the artist a chance. I said, if you want to scrap it out, I have the money in my pocket. Let's go. Before that I was a bouncer and he was a skinny British guy and I'm not going to punch someone in the face, but I'll wrestle you down and, make sure you ain't getting what's in my pocket. Right. So, and he backed down from that pretty quick. And the next day the whole band made him apologize. And so that was like my first, confrontation when it came to, substance use as a tour manager. When I was in my own bands, guys like to dabble in it and all that stuff. And I was like, I've never been much of a drinker myself. And I was, like I said, I was like the mom or dad of the tour. So I was like, no matter how hammered everyone got, I was driving. They all knew they had someone babysit them, right?
Well, I want to take a step back because at one point you mentioned that when you were, with your bands, you knew that what you guys were doing wasn't sustainable.
Right.
And then that's when, you saw the ad for learning how to be a TM. Tell me a little bit more about that little part.
A lot was going on. In addition to all that, I was trying to start a rehearsal space business in my local. I had a building, 4,000 square foot building. And I kind of got scammed by the landlord. That's a different story for another time, but we lost a lot of money and went to go sue the guy. It turns out I was number 7 on the suing list and he would have gone bankrupt and I would have just owed lawyers money. So I just had to suck it up, right? So while all this was going on, we had a big last party at this place. And, I had the building for a number of months and then I didn't. And then my band was just like the last show, just people, my bass player smashed his bass. And it was like, okay, that was kind of like the sign that it's over, right? It like without it, no one said it was, but it was always like, okay, like he wrecked up his bass and that's it was just a signal that we all know it was time to move on. So I sort of trying to find like, where I was like a sort of in limbo. I got no band. I wanted this jam space really to work. That didn't work. Lost a bunch of money. I had to come up with a new game plan, right? Or else my fallback before that was always like working temp jobs. So I was working like in factories. I was a pole polisher. I was a door maker. I worked in print shops, roofing, just all the manual labor jobs. But I would never commit to those either because that was never my goal. It was always the music, right? So during that time, when I was sort of in limbo, I was just working all these temp jobs, a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there. And then yeah, I was a limbo, and then I seen this ad, and it was just like, okay, maybe this is my second breath here. Because I knew the factory work would be kind of where I ended up. I grew up dyslexic. The education system really didn't recognize it as a thing. It wasn't called dyslexic at the time. It was just called a learning disability. I had taken all these tests in grade six. And then they identified that there was an issue. So they stuck me in ESL as a second language class.
You're like, I don't know any other languages.
Yeah. But they also didn't have the teaching tools at the time to sort of like work with it. And then by the time I got into high school, any help that I was getting was just dropped. Right. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So it's like on, you know, although I did want to work in business, writing is not my friend. You know, I've about 10 different editor friends, you know,
So you were kind of just like, you know, things were crazy with the band, mm-hmm. and you recognized that because that really wasn't the type of vibe that you normally have, right? Because were you pretty chill or were you like,
yeah,
like, were you in it and then you just decided to stop? Like, what happened with you like as a person?
Well, I was always in it, but I was never the partier. Right. I was too young to get, I wasn't quite sick of it yet. And that's all I kind of known. Cause it was kind of like my high school band and we're all buddies and I was put up with their shit and I was babysitting them and all that. And, it was just like every weekend was a party. But at the same time, like when I had to get business time, it's like, oh, okay, we have to go postering, you know, well, who's going to make up the posters? Well, Ace has a computer. Well, I have, I paint, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I, you know, go cut out a bunch of letters out of a magazine, tape them to something else, take them to the corner store, photocopy it, you know, then go out. But when I went out with the guys, we'd end up stopping at four bars and only getting like three blocks done. Meanwhile, if I was by myself, I was like, well, I can get, you know, the whole area done by myself, put a set of rollerblades on and off I go. You know, I got stopped by the police a bunch of times for putting posters up on there. And they'd be like, do you know how much it costs to remove this? And because I worked at the pole factory as a pole polisher, I'm like, yes, I can tell you exactly. And actually it's ridiculous that they take this shit down for someone to go, whoops, and clean it up. It's quite ridiculous. Right.
Oh, man.
So the cops would let me go because I, you know, have the smarts. I'm like, actually, it costs $623.
And you're like, I'm actually very professional and I know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's okay.
You know, luckily I never got ticketed, but I definitely got stopped a few times. And, you know, because they'd always like, you know how much this costs? I'm like, I do. You know, because I clean them. I'm the guy. You know who's going to be cleaning them? Yeah, me.
I love that. Man, okay. So then it seems like you kind of just outgrew that stage in your life and maybe an opportunity popped up and it turned out to be the right opportunity, huh?
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. And then kind of once we kind of got into it, I started hitting the road. I started meeting other tour managers. And in Canada, every tour manager is double dutied. Like, like 80% of the Canadian tour managers are sound guys. Like, it's just the way it works, right?
There was a meme I think I saw yesterday where it was like from The Office, like showing, you know, they're like, corporate wants you to tell me the difference between these two pictures, and one's FOH and the other one is tour manager, right? Yeah. And like, she goes, they're the same picture.
Yeah. And so like, I'm looking at my buddies. I'm like, how'd you get that gig? He's like, well, like, these are sound guys who became tour managers, and I wasn't a sound guy yet. So then I went to the local club. I met up with my buddy, Jer, who was still like, he wasn't a high-end sound guy, but he was a sound guy. And I go, hey, can you teach me? He goes, no, not really. Right. And I go, well, you're going to teach me. So I know you have a show on Friday and Saturday. So I'm going to show up about 3 hours before the doors. He's like, oh, well, you'll be waiting outside. We arrived 90 minutes before the doors open. All right. Because it's a small club and all that. And so I'm like, okay, I'll be there 2 hours. I'll be there before you. I'll be waiting. Right. And he's like, I don't want you to come. And I said, too bad.
He's like, I'm not a teacher. I don't know how to explain what I do. I just do it. So
yeah,
you know, I don't know you.
Later on in our friendship, that's what he told me, right? He's like, dude, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm like, oh, like, I knew how to play drums. You know, he taught me how to like rap chords and and everything. And then once I got to a point where we were kind of equal, then we'd like, it's like learn about compression and gates and things like that together. And like, okay, well, what happens if you throw an echo or delay on a drum, right? But since we don't do that, we're just doing it live during shows, right? Just, you know, just kind of learning our craft.
You're like, oh, that was the wrong button.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you get a lot of like, you know, singers, like I didn't know how to ring out a monitor. So I'm, you know, singers are pointing at the monitors as feedback. And I'm getting some girlfriend's mom, some singer's mom tell me she can't hear her baby sing, or her girlfriend's, the guitar player's girlfriend tell me that he's not loud enough. And, you know, like I'm getting everybody's opinion. And because I wasn't confident, it's kind of screws with your head a little bit when you're just kind of throwing yourself into the deep water and trying to swim, right? So.
Oh, man. So was that happening when you took that tour and it was with, you know, that the lead singer had a problem with cocaine and stuff?
Right.
Like, were you also learning how to do sound at that time, or was this prior to that?
No, that was post that.
Oh, okay.
So it was about 6 months after, because when I started touring, then people are like, oh, you're tour managing now, right? I'm like, yeah. So then they started recognizing me, and then I was like recognizing who, what sound guy buddies became tour managers, because I didn't know, right? So, and then I'm like, how are you getting these gigs? And once again, I became the dance tour manager because I'm the local sound guy. I'm like, oh shit, I need to learn how to do sound. So, but yeah, for those tours, you know, like I was also accountant and driver and merch setter upper and stage manager, and that's just on top of, you know. And then once I learned sound, I didn't necessarily get paid more, you know, but it was just like another skill that I could add.
And yeah, it just opened more doors, right?
Yeah.
You were put in situations where you had to learn different skills. And so you know, you learned how to be a tour manager, and you learned how to be a sound guy, and you learned how to do all the things.
Mm-hmm.
Where does it come in where you started to kind of look at not just your job as like a utilitarian thing where, you know, you have certain tasks to complete, but you had to really start taking care of the people that were involved?
Yeah. So that one came, I was probably a TM for about 4 or 5 years at that point. And I was out with an artist who was in recovery, and I was told beforehand, you know, make sure that, you know, no drugs get on the bus. And if so, you know, kick them off and all the stuff. Right. So about a week into a 6 week tour, the artist had some old party buddies came on the bus. As soon as I realized, I tried to kick him out, you know, then he starts fighting me, right? He's like, no, it's these guys are okay. They're the exceptions. And I didn't really know so much about that. You know what I mean? So I was like I living in Hamilton, I grew up around drugs. You know, my neighbors have died of it. There's a homeless shelter down the street from me. When it was time for me to learn about drugs, my dad took me to the homeless shelter, paid each guy $5 to tell me how they ended up there. You know, so I'm talking. So I'm like 10 years old talking to a heroin junkie, but it's like 100 degrees out and he's wearing a long sleeve shirt. And my dad's like, oh, so why, you know, what's under your sleeve? And the guy has an infective needle marks in his arm. And, you know, then we go on to the next guy who's all tripping balls because he's been doing acid and all that stuff for a lifetime. And then he was like, oh, here's the alcoholic. Here's the guy who suffers with mental health. Here's the guy who suffers with mental health and copes with all these drugs. So he took me down like all the entire list of drugs to each person. And I heard all their stories.
Why did he do that? Why do you think he used that particular method?
It's just the way my dad is. You know, if he's going to show you why not to run across the street, he's going to have a buddy drive a car down, and he's going to throw a soccer ball in front of him and be like, hey, there's your head. There you go, kid.
Wow. I mean, I'm curious though, have you ever like dug into like, why is my dad this way?
No, not really. He just I think he learns better by examples. So he gives examples to teach you, right? So, and
do you think it works? Yeah.
It has, you know, even grown up a little bit further. Now that stuff, my dad wasn't a user, but his buddies were, right? So we'd get a couple knocks on the doors at 2 o'clock, you know, in the morning and all that stuff. And, you know, by his buddies just wanting to hang out. And he's like, I got to work. Like, what are you doing? Right. So
it's interesting to hear about your dad, because I feel like our parents, whether we like it or not, end up being a huge part of who we are. And so I'm interested to hear about how, you know, that straightforward method of teaching you without lecturing you, but really by using stories, firsthand stories, mm-hmm. and firsthand examples, how that has impacted your life.
How he came up with that method, I don't know, but he did, and he showed me directly. You know, we lived right down the street from this bar called the Corktown, which is like Hamilton's, like CBGB's, sort of rock and roll mecca for years and years and years. So when we walk by there, you know, you see the drunk guys fighting and the junkies passed out, and, you know, a guy shitting himself over there. And it was just sort of in the area. So he wanted to tell me why those people were like that in those situations, rather than just being like, oh, they're, you know, you don't talk to them sort of stuff, right? You want to understand.
Do you think that gave you a little bit more empathy toward them?
I think so, because I'd seen a lot of those people, you know, when they're messed up and then when they were not. And when they were not, I would see them in the neighborhood with their kids and their families. But, you know, if they didn't have any responsibilities that day, or if the addiction got the better of them for that day, it would be a 50-50 chance if I would see them laying on the corner, or if they were out like looking like everything was fine with their family.
And that's quite the contrast, right? Like being able to see the difference that it makes just to, you know, to have a substance that completely changes who you are.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of wild growing up, right? So, but yeah, just going back to that story though. So like that artist came on, and or those buddies of the artist came on, and then he had relapse. I'd let the management and agents know. All they cared about was, is he making it to stage? They didn't give a shit about anything else, right? So about 2 weeks into his relapse, you know, the pills were back on the bus and all this stuff. I'm arguing with him every day. You know, we're supposed to do meet and greets before. Now he doesn't want to do the meet and greets before. He wants to do them after. But at the same time, he wants me to wrangle up the girls that he's seen and make sure they're happy while he's trying to go through this 50-person meet and greet that he's given 2 seconds to each person who's paid $50 to. And I'm just sitting here just like, oh my God, like this is not fun. We had talked about doing the meet and greets, you know, 2 hours before doors. We had talked about doing this. And then as soon as the substance came in, it was over, right? But there was one instance where we're in Red Deer, and me and him got in a 4-hour fight because he went to a 15-minute interview. You know, he didn't want to be woken up before 1 o'clock. And for interviews, I had to schedule him 3 hours after he had gotten up, right? Because he wouldn't do it before. So, okay. So I got to wake him up at 1, and he won't do any interviews before 4. Got it. Cool. So here I am trying to wake him up at 1 to do an interview at 5:30, right? And I couldn't get him up out of bed. We spent a couple hours arguing that because he wouldn't do it. Like I'd have the radio station on the line. I'd pass on the phone. He'd just hang up. And he's in his bunk. He's not moving. I'm just like, dude, talk for 6 minutes. That's all you need. But instead, he decided to fight for a bunch of hours with me. So after that disagreement, I got off the bus. I was furiated and frustrated, and, you know, was about to hop on the next plane home. And then a fan came up to me, and this was the pivot moment, is he wanted to meet the artist. And I said, you know, he's doing interviews right now. So now I'm covering for the guy, right? And I'm like, well, there's a meet and greet later. You could, you know, buy and say what you need to then. And he goes, no, it needs some one-on-one time. I'm like, oh, tell me about it. So this artist, before he had relapsed, he had put out a couple albums about his recovery, talking about it, right? So after he had relapsed, he's going up on stage. Instead of just performing the songs, he's giving a speech every night going, hey, I've been sober for 3.5 years, and it's the best time of my life. And I'm like, you just did a line 20 minutes ago, you lying son of a bitch, right? And so that was really heartbroken. So now this fan comes up to me saying that he's been in active addiction for 11 years, overdosed 3 times, clinically died twice. His girlfriend was with him throughout it all. She's standing there. She's crying. Oh, did it all. Tears running down her face and all that. And then, and that he has been sober at this point for 11 months because the music, during his addiction, he had gone into detox and rehab and all the programs, AA, NA, you name it, he's been to it, but none of them was able to click with him. He was so immersed into the hip hop culture that regular English was almost like a foreign language to him. He was so into the Ebonics. He was so into the lifestyle that when he was talking and working with people outside that community, it was almost like English was a second language, although he was a white guy from the middle of the woods where I think he'd be cutting down trees, but he's not. He's in houses doing his drug of choice and just feeding in all the hip hop culture news and trying to live all the lyrics that he's taken in over the last 15 years, right? He's trying to live the life that really doesn't exist. You know, you listen to some of these songs and they're talking about, you know, doing drugs, doing violent stuff and all that. And he thought that's what it meant to be cool. So that's how he lived his life. But when he had listened to this artist's album about his recovery, recovery was put into a way that that he could understand. And that just clicked with me. I was like, oh my God, we all know music is a language and it's out there. And, you know, music has helped me through some heartbreaks. It's helped me through some ups and downs, but it's never helped me through something like that. You know, I've never lived in a situation like that where I've had to turn to music in order to be my only resource of help. Right. So after that tour, I really thought what I can do. It took me a little bit of time. I didn't know what to do. And then, I went on tour with a Canadian rock band called Monster Truck, and we're opening up for Alice in Chains. And Chains is a band in recovery. And, you know, when they decided to get back together, they said, you know, whether it's smoking pot or right casual drinking, we don't want none of that stuff. And their tour manager was also their AA sponsor. Yeah, and that gentleman also worked with like Grateful Dead in the 80s and stuff like that. And so there'd be a couple times when we're having our daily, you know, briefings, you know, where are we going to park the bus tomorrow, you know, and whatever for the next day. We just got in these conversations about his role in different artists' recovery, and I thought that was the coolest shit I've ever heard, right? I'm like, so you're out here as a tour manager, and you're being in this life support for them. And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, that's cool.
That's wild. Yeah. And it's like, because they're already, you know, he's already working so closely, basically like managing their entire life while they're on tour. Mm-hmm. But now there's this other element where he's charged with also taking care of them as humans and taking care of their mental health and helping them through this really difficult time.
Yeah. Oh, and I also thought it was an interesting position to be in, because I've heard of recovery coaches going out there and stuff like that, and we both know a couple. the thing is when you do have a recovery coach, and I'm not shitting on recovery coaches at all who go out on tour, right? But the reality is like, if you want to keep it on the down low, there's going to be questions on who's this person who's not doing merch and not doing anything else, right? But when you got someone in the crew, it doesn't necessarily have to be the TM, you know, that is already on there for a job. So, and if you do want to keep that information on the down low, that you're able to, right? And instead of someone, a recovery coach going, hey, tour manager, like I need this time and this time with this artist tomorrow. Make sure to put that, you know, on the call sheet for, you know, or the artist's schedule tomorrow. That doesn't need to be done. You know, it's just like they know, you know, and I don't schedule anything. It doesn't need to be in any master tour. It doesn't need to be anything. If they want to be that anonymous about it, right? I just know every day at 3 o'clock, that's him and I time. I don't schedule anything. All right. And no one's the wiser. So after that tour, I just thought it was, you know, that dude was like the coolest thing. And I didn't really know him all that well. So after that, I came back into Hamilton. I thought, like, do I pick up an addiction and go through AA? Or then I'm like, yeah, that's probably not the smartest thing to do. And then I ended up deciding to go back to school, getting a certificate in addictions counseling. I volunteered at a whole bunch of shelters and programs and things like that. And one of my volunteer positions ended up leading to a paid job being a counselor. So I was working with both mandated and non-mandated clients. So some of them want to be there in their free will. Some of them do not. You know, so I'm getting guys freshly out of jail who have, you know, tear tattoos on their face, telling me to go screw myself and all this stuff. And then by week three, they got real tears going down their tattoo tears.
So I'm wondering, you know, when that fan came up to you, and he really made it click that when you speak to someone in their language, that can be all the difference. How did that particular thing play into the way that you dealt with your clients when you found yourself in this position of being their support?
Well, everyone wants to be understood, and it's usually best if you have an understanding on where people are coming from. And I know the music industry is a unique industry with a lot of unique challenges, personalities. You know, you got some of the old guards that are a little crusty, who've been there for too long. They learned by getting yelled at and bitched at, and it wasn't much of a positive reinforcement atmosphere as it was of like, I'm not going to tell you what you've done right, but I'm going to tell you what you've done wrong. So, sort of thing, right? And it's good to know that, because when I do work with, you know, clients who are in that age range and have that sort of mentality, I need to understand that. And not just that, but I need to understand the culture of the music industry. What is it like being away from home for 6 months without seeing your family? You know, you're sure, you know, tour bunks are fine and dandy for a couple days, you know, but once you get into 6, 8, 10, 12 week tours, like, Jesus Christ, it gets tough. And those people would prefer someone who understands that lifestyle. So I did have opportunities to stop touring in the music industry and to just work addictions counseling. And I was very honored by those asks, but I wouldn't be helping the people that I knew the most, you know, because I can relate to, being on buses to, touring in minivans, you know, whatever stage you're at, like I've lived it. You know, I could tell you about the shitty times that I've slept on some chick's front lawn. And like, we parked our van in someone's driveway only for their dad to come running out and chase us around. And we're just a van trying to make it to, like, you know, doing things on the arena level, you know, and as different artists or artists that are at different stages of their career all the time, you know, different positions. So it's nice to be able to talk with someone who has a general understanding of not just the problems that you're going through, but the culture and lifestyle that you live.
How open are people to talking about these sorts of issues. How wide is the spectrum, and where do you think that is going? Like, on what trajectory is it?
I am glad you asked that question. So far, it has been a very difficult question to ask or conversation to have. I've been put in situations where I'm on panels at conferences and everyone's, oh, I'm coming. Next thing you know, we're talking to 10 people, 15 people. And there's like 5,000 people outside those doors, right? And people's hearts are in it, but it is a tough conversation to have, right? And it's the music industry is funny, is that because like we are willing to do and work any concert for any other charities, benefits, you know, whether it's cancer or Feed the Children or whatever. And those are all great causes. I'm not taking anything away from them. But what I've realized is that the music industry sort of has this look, is like they have a hard time acknowledging it because it can't be happening to me. But yeah, I talk to 12 to 20 people a week about this, but yet very few people are willing to talk publicly about it. So for example, like, you know, someone's trying to put together a fundraiser for cancer, you know, artists like, I'm all over that. Try to put together a fundraiser for your own industry. People are afraid to, because that means that they're talking out on their own behalf. And people are really afraid of the stigma. I talk to a lot of crew people who are nervous about, maybe they've talked about it once and they almost got blacklisted from that tour because they're like, are you sure you can handle it? You know, like someone may be dealing with something at home and having a bad day, maybe a little low, or maybe depression's kicking in, you know, because the tour wasn't what they had hoped it would be, or maybe just, you know, some people are just grinding each other's gears, you know, the boys are at the gigs, you know, you just sort of, you screw around, you call each other names a little bit and all that. But if someone's having a bad day, you know, that could ruin anyone's day. And that's not even talking about depression, you know, something that's just in there. Like I'm in a unique position, I believe, is because I suffer from very little mental health issues. You know, I call it situational depression, because if I get low, it's because something's happened, right? Like, you know, I know the cause and, you know, and that's the effect of it, as opposed to someone who doesn't have that reason and is wondering. Because of my bring up, I never fell into the substance abuse category. But with mental health, is like, my mom suffers from depression. She was on meds for a lot of years. Menopause came. Those meds didn't work before for anymore. And then we tried a whole bunch and then they still weren't working. And then electric shock treatment came into place. And I went to 8 out of 12 electric shock treatments, where I watched my mom flop all over the table like a fish, like out of like the end of the Faith No More video. It's the saddest thing you ever want to see, right? And like I was flying home from gigs, Saturday night gigs, that land at 6 o'clock in the morning to be at the hospital for 7:30 on at a Sunday electric shock treatment, you know, like going straight from the airport there, driving from Montreal back to Hamilton, which is 7-8 hours, you know, overnight just to be back there. Right. Cause you have to be there. So after seeing that stuff, right. And, you know, it got to a point where that didn't work, you know, or the electric shock was supposed to help in 12 and the doctors made it sound as if like, oh, on number 12, you'll be fixed. Well, they didn't tell you that it's like taking your brain like a snow globe and watching all the little, you know, snow pieces fall. And sometimes it takes months for that to happen. So when the doctors tell you this is your last option and the last option isn't working right now because you've done your 12 and you're still in as much of a depression, if not more of a depression, and then like you feel there's no hope at that point, right? It got to the point where my mom called me up one day and asked me if she'd be upset if she took her own life, right?
Oh, wow.
So, and I had to tell her, I'm like, Mom, and she goes, would you forgive me? And I said, Mom, I can't, I don't live the life you do. I'm not in your head. I think it's unfair that you're asking me for permission But again, I'm also not the one living in your head. So you can make that decision, but it's not going to be with my blessings. Right. And whatever I said, she goes, you know, it kept her going for the other day, for the rest of the day. I stayed on the phone. I jumped in a cab and went to her house and, you know, we wrote it out together. Right. So, and that's why I'm the mental health advocate that I am. And then once I started doing that, people just open up to me. They talk about the stressors of the industry, the inconsistency of work, you know, either sometimes you're on fire, but when you're on fire, you're never home. So there's no balance.
It's just such high highs and such low lows.
Yeah, you go from from a crazy top speed of 100 miles an hour to zero to the next day, and then there's a crash and burn. I describe that as post-tour depression, and actually about post-tour depression is I read an article about that while I was in school. And I reached out to the author of it and I asked, like, hey, where did you get your facts about your depression? Like, how do you know this is a real thing? And he told me everything was anecdotal. So, which means, you know, there's no study facts on it. Everything is just like people talking about it. So I did a Google, I looked around, I found a whole bunch of musicians blogging about it in chat rooms, on the personal sites and things like that, but there was nothing in there. So that sparked a little, ignited a little something in me. So I reached out to my neighbor who happens to be a professor at McMaster University. And McMaster is very well known for the research. They're actually doing COVID-19 vaccine testing there right now. Like they're huge in the medical research, right? So I went through there and I've been working on the study for a couple of years. We're able to get 412 musicians to participate, and we're currently analyzing the data with a data analyst team from Georgian College. And what it does is the study measures what a musician's post-performance mood response is, so whether it's high or low or maybe neutral in the middle, and then how do they manage it? So do they use substances? Maybe it's alcohol, maybe it's drugs, maybe it's meditation, maybe they call somebody. Maybe they go to the gym, you know, but I've never seen an artist go. I think I've seen it once where one artist is like, oh, I need to go for a run after my gig. I'm like, wow. Okay.
You're like, huh?
Yeah. It's the only time it's ever happened.
Wow. You know, I don't know. The only word I know how to use is synchronicity, because the chances of your neighbor being a researcher at this renowned university where the capabilities are there for there to be some real data, because I feel like, you know, we were talking about the stigma that comes from airing out, you know, your issues and I feel like, you know, definitely in American culture, I'm not sure how it is in Canada, but, you know, it's almost like in order for something to be real, you need science to tell you that it's real and you need data to tell you that it's real, because the anecdotes, although very valuable, I mean, and we see this in the health and wellness space, you know, for so many years, people were saying leaky gut and, you know, there's microbes in your gut that affect your mood and they do this. But until they started to actually study it and they found actual evidence, people thought it was this crazy nonsense that, you know, hippies cared about. Yeah. And so, you know, I feel like that is actually a really great thing for, you know, for the industry and for mental health as a whole, because it's going to really validate people's anecdotes, which I think is incredibly valuable for people to actually want to do something about it and be able to speak out loud.
Yeah. And before you're able to do anything, first you need to identify it. Well, once we're able to identify, you know, how low of a mood is, you know, maybe we could identify how low of a mood is post performance depression, right? But once we identify, and basically we'll be writing there's never been a study on the subject before, which is like blew me away, not in sports, not anything else, right? So once we're able to do this, we could cross it to athletes and all that if we wanted to. right? And we've already started talking to other people who want to do follow-up studies and build off of those initial ones. So, but once again, it was like, I read this article. I'm not a researcher, right? So, but I just seen this and I'm like, this is important. So I went to my neighbor, but I knew he worked at Mac. I didn't know he was a teacher there, right? Like he's a therapist and counselor actually, who works there. And, but I've been neighbors with the guy for 5 years, but man, he could have been, he looks like a hipster dude with a big red beard. You know, he's kayaks all the time. And like, you know,
he could have done anything else.
I thought he was maybe like working in the gardens. He could have been a garden guy. I didn't freaking know. I knew he was a good guy. He has a great family, great kids, a great wife and all that stuff. But I didn't really know anything about him. And then he's like, just shooting the shit. And he's like, you know, I'm a therapist, right? I'm like, no. And then the next day I was like, oh, I read this thing and I brought it over. And then
you're like, our talk was amazing.
Yeah. And then he sent me to the ethics board, you know, and the ethics board gave me every chance to do this on my own, but I knew it wouldn't hold any water if it was just some dude, you know what I mean? We really needed the university to back us up on this. So it's been a long process. We've had some, we've definitely had some up and downs, you know, data analysts I'm finding are as flaky as musicians. So, but, you know, once you find a good one, you know, they're there. So I've been lucky to finally find a team that's able to work with us and very interested in building up on top of this. So, yeah, but once we get those findings out, like I said, we got to identify it. Once it's identified, then what do we do about it? What's the aftercare? So, you know, like we're talking over on the webinar that you and I did together, you know, it's like, maybe it would be good for the TM to organize a couple of like, debriefings after, you know, a couple one-on-ones, you know, or set up a counselor or a therapist that do those tour one-on-ones, with them, you know, what was good, what was bad, what could have been better, you know, and, hey, and not only about that, how are you doing that your home? You know, because if one thing that I've sort of put together by talking with single people and married people is when people who have families, they get home, they have the support, they tend to fall into sort of a regular routine a little bit more because they got kids to take to school and things like that. But sometimes if you're single and you don't got those responsibilities and you're not living with anybody, well, I guess you want to tell your stories to someone, you want someone to listen to you. So there's a good chance you might end up at your old venue that you used to work at. And guess what? You're the rock star guy who just got off tour with whoever. And now everyone wants to hear about all your awesome tour stories and you'll give, you know, people will pay you in beers for your stories. So, you know, in a normal
life, you never get a chance to actually, you know, rest.
Yeah. So in substance use is only normalizing, glamorizing our industry. I think it's becoming a little bit better nowadays. Like people are starting to recognize the dangers of it and all that. But, you know, if this is how you've been managing your struggles for a lot of years, then, you know, you don't know how to manage it any other way. So what do you do? So once we get through this, our next job is to put together a kit on how to on how to manage your post performance mood response or your post tour mood response, right? You know how you know you got your highs and lows. Was it a great tour? Was it a bad tour? Great show. What are you going to do? Or a great tour? You're going to celebrate and keep drinking for a long time, or are you going to? If it was a bad tour, maybe you're going to manage that with substances. Or are you going to talk with someone? Are you going to make plans? You know, you miss out on a lot of things, you know, from get-togethers and weddings, you know, births and deaths and everyday things. And that does, although we try and not to let that bother us, it sticks in the back of our head. You know, for every niece and nephew that was born or every uncle or grandfather that there's funeral that you couldn't go to because you're stuck in Wisconsin at a shitty red roof motel, you know what I mean, for a couple hundred bucks. And if you leave that tour, well, you're not just leaving for a couple of days, you're leaving the tour for good. And, you know, maybe we need more understandings that like on the road, it's like, hey, if someone needs to go because there's a funeral or someone's, you know, we should be able to have them back when they're feeling better. You know, whose responsibility is it to get them back and forth? You know, that's a conversation to have. It's a bit, if it's a bigger tour, maybe they can help out, split it. If it's a smaller one and you need to go, then that's your own thing, right? Maybe someone on the tour can fill in your position for a day or two. You know, if you're a tour manager and also have a production manager, you know, that production manager could hold things off for like 2 days while you fly in and out, because those are things that happen in your life, and it's not fair to you. It's not fair to your family that you're missing out. And it's also not fair to the tour, because if you're missing out on that, then you become a little jaded and you're pissed off at the artist, or you're pissed off at your TM or your PM or whoever, right? Thinking that you can't go and experience these life things. But if you had a 9-to-5 job, yeah, you know, Tuesday afternoon funeral would be no thing. Take the afternoon off. You might get a little flack for it, but, you know, I'll see you on Wednesday morning.
You know, Ed, I love everything that you're saying. And it you know, it really makes me realize that, you know, a lot of it has to do with everyone understanding that this is important. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like there's a lot of fear that can come from requesting that time, you know, because everyone in the back of their mind is thinking, okay, well, if I ask for this time that I really need, am I risking my job? And am I ever going to get a job after that? Like that, I feel like, right? I mean, am I wrong?
Being a human has turned into being a liability.
It has, absolutely.
And that is sad. That hurts my heart. Mm-hmm.
No. It really does. And I really hope that out of all of this, you know, now that we've had time and more time than a lot of us have wanted to really sit with ourselves and, like, you know, think about the fact that we are human and we do have needs and we can't just keep going like Energizer bunnies mm-hmm. and expect everything to be okay. I hope that, you know, it sets more of a group mentality and a community where you start to realize, like, no, like, you know, this isn't just about the job, and this isn't just about checking off a bunch of tasks. This is really about getting to know the people that I work with, having that be a part of my life as a whole, and me caring about those people, and maybe taking away some of that fear that comes from communicating what you need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. Like, there's so much fear and stigma about being a human, and then when you're talking about mental health, or if someone's in recovery, then they're stigmatized and people don't want to work, you know, and then for, I don't want to say just females, but it's more frequent in females, is, you know, sexual harassment, you know, when you're out on the road, and the stigma of speaking up. And because then, you know, I've talked to a number of ladies where they've been sexually harassed and they bring it up and someone just goes, well, that's the gig, baby. Are you taking it or you're not? Like, it's up to you. So it's like, oh, I signed up to sell merchandise or set up the stage. I didn't sign up to get sexually harassed. You know, the majority of the male don't sign up for that and they don't receive that. You know, but if the shoe was on the other foot, it'd be totally, you know, offside, right? It'd be handled in a completely different way. So. For those who don't suffer from mental health, I don't suffer, like I mentioned earlier, but we need to learn what mental health is about so we can have a little bit more compassion. It doesn't always have to be empathy. You don't have to feel what the person, if you do have that skill, that's amazing, but not all people do. But what we can do is educate ourselves on what mental health is, or mental illness is, you know, so we can have a little bit of compassion, because having a 5-minute talk with somebody of like, hey, I don't understand what you're feeling, but I do understand, it's you can say you don't understand the feeling, but I understand the pain that you're going through, you know, because I think, especially when by the time you get to adults, you've gone through some pain, you know, and discomfort. And I know that because you live it, because you work in the music industry. You are on a learning curve. We all learn. And when we learn, it hurts sometimes because, you know, we make mistakes, we get yelled at, we do, you know, we're not proud, we get ashamed of our mistakes and all that other stuff. So like everyone in the music industry, you've had to be tough enough to get into it, you know, to work your way out onto the road and get it out there. But in to add on mental illness or a mental health struggle, you know, we need a little bit of understanding by those who don't suffer from it. I don't know. Like, I don't know anybody here who's ever lived, you know, in a third world country, but guess what? They give to third world country charities, you know, or hunger project, and they've never had to go a day without food in their life. So we do give and we do have understanding. We are capable of it. But unfortunately, it's just that understanding is not given to the people that we know. It's given to strangers. It's given to people that we don't have to look at night. But when we go back to our beds, we go to our hotel rooms, we go back to our buses, and we look across that little, you know, 18-inch hallway, you know, to see that curtain open, you know, that's a real person that we are living with. You know, there was a question that was asked in that webinar, and I really got kind of upset with the answer from a lot of people, was like, should a tour manager ask people if they are suffering from mental illnesses? And a lot of people said no, because it's personal, right? And that's my information. And people, guess what? We're living in the same quarters. That's personal. I'm seeing your boxers in the morning, and at the end of the night, you know, I'm seeing you curse and swear. I know what you're eating. I know when you're taking your shit. I know when you're doing everything. You're telling me that's not personal? So my thoughts, you know, someone even said, well, it could turn into an insurance liability. I don't know anything about that stuff, but all I do know is that if we don't take the time to understand what we are going through, we are going to lose a lot of good people in this industry, you know, who all they need is a little bit of understanding. So I ask for those who don't struggle with mental illnesses, just, you know, there's enough TED Talks up there. You know, there's enough information about that. If you don't do that research, you're just friggin' ignorant, right? Like, there's so many, and I understand there's a lot of things we need to educate ourselves, especially right now in the political climate, you know, from the forest fires to the presidential stuff to COVID. There's a lot of crazy shit going on, right? And there's a lot of information to digest. But all that is affecting our mental health. You know, we're not working. We're not doing anything. We're struggling. We're swearing. We're pissed off at the world. We're pissed off at each other. We're pissed off at ourselves. You know, and we need to give ourselves a little bit of forgiveness. We need to be kind to ourselves so we can be kind to the people we spend our time with. That includes our road family. And, you know, especially that term road family. I hear that, you know, whether it's on Bobnet or on whatever tour, there's always a road family. You know, if we're a road family, we'd know about each other's struggles and we'd be there to support them. So let's be a true road family. Let's get to know each other. Let's learn our struggles so we can support them and help them. You know, stop putting them down if someone's struggling. Stop putting people down because you're a fucking asshole if you do. So,
and that's drop the mic, because that was perfect. Oh man. Yeah. You know, I love it. And I hope that this conversation makes people feel more comfortable in just having a conversation, because, you know, like you said, when you try to make things really formal and then, you know, people start worrying about liability and all this stuff, sometimes it doesn't need to be that complicated. No. Sometimes it can be as easy as just asking a question in private as a friend. And, you know, it doesn't need to be more than that. And that could be enough to bridge you over the issue, yeah. Right?
And that one question is actually two questions. How are you doing right now? And what can I listen for? You know, just listen. Just shut up and fucking listen. You don't have to be a therapist. You don't have to be, just listen and don't give your opinion. And if it's, and if you feel that you're going to be being a little snarky or giving it, just be like, you know what? I know you're going through some, I may not be the best person to talk to right now. And you can say, maybe because I'm going through my own stuff, and that's okay. Not everyone's a great listener, but don't be calling people out and making people feel small for being born with a mental illness, you know, and because it sucks. It friggin' sucks. I see people struggle all the friggin' time, and it sucks. The last thing anybody needs is someone else just being a fucking asshole about it.
Exactly. Oh, I love it. Well, Ace, I'm going to share the contact information for your organization, Over the Bridge, in the show notes, and people can find you on Instagram. So I'll share that too. And, hopefully we can all help each other feel more comfortable in all of this, because I know that, believe it or not, even when we say that, you know, we may not personally be struggling with mental illness or with depression or anything of the like, I really do believe that all of our issues, regardless of the severity that we think they are valid. And I think they're important. And I think we have to give them value and we have to address them, and we can't be afraid. So hopefully this will help make people lose a little bit of that fear. Thank you so, so much for coming on the show. I appreciate you so much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Have a good night. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Ace Piva. 1. People learn better by example. Use firsthand stories and examples to really teach the lesson, not just tell it. 2. When you're in the limelight, don't lie about your experience, because fans truly do look up to you, and what you say and do truly does matter. 3. Speak to people in their own language. If you want to help people, put forth the effort to learn where people are coming from and what their experience, culture, and lifestyle really is before you start spitting out advice. 4. When you have influence, it's important to put yourself out there. The stigma of openly talking about mental illness will only disappear when everyone starts being honest and open. And 5. The conversation around mental health in the music industry is complex, and it's only just beginning. It's up to everyone at every level of the industry to understand how important mental health is. Being a human should not be a liability. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Ace and Over the Bridge a follow on Instagram at AcePiva and at OTB Nonprofit. And don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow The Tour Life on Instagram at The Tour Life Podcast.